2. Other cities slept away the winter months, but Red London showed no signs of retreat. As the two brothers walked the streets, elemental fires burned in every hearth, steam drifting from the chimneys, and through his clouded breath Kell saw the haloed lights of the night market lining the bank, the scent of mulled wine and stew drifting on the steam, and the streets bustling with scarf-wrapped figures in jewel-toned cloaks. Rye was right. Kell was the only one dressed in black. He pulled the cap down over his brow to shield him less from the cold than the inevitable looks. A pair of young women strolled past, arm in arm, and when one caught a favoring glance at Rye, nearly tripping over her skirts, he caught her elbow.
"Anne, solas res noster," she apologized.
"Mas merest,"
replied Rye in his effortless Arnesian. The girl didn't seem to notice Kell, who still hung a step back, half in the bank's shadow. But her friend did. He could feel her eyes hanging on him, and when he finally met her gaze, he felt a grim satisfaction at her indrawn breath.
"Avon," said Kell, his voice little more than fog.
"Avon,"
she said stiffly, bowing her head. Rye pressed his lips to the other girl's gloved fingers, but Kell didn't take his eyes off the one watching him. There had been a time when Arnesians worshipped him as blessed, fell over themselves trying to bow low enough. While he never relished that display, this was worse. There was a measure of reverence in her eyes, but also fear, and, worse, distrust. She looked at him as if he were a dangerous animal, as if any sudden movement might cause him to strike. After all, as far as she knew, he was to blame for the black night that had swept the city, the magic that made people's eyes turn as black as his own as it ate them from the inside out. And no matter what statements the king and queen issued, no matter how many rumors Rye tried to spread to the contrary, everyone believed it was Kell's doing, his fault. And in a way, of course, it was. He felt Rye's hand on his shoulder and blinked. The girls were walking away, arm in arm, whispering furiously. Kell sighed and looked back at the royal palace, arcing over the river.
"This was a bad idea," he said again, but Rye was already off, heading away from the night market and the glow of the aisle.
"Where are we going?" asked Kell, falling into step behind the prince.
"It's a surprise."
"Rye," warned Kell, who had come to hate surprises.
"Fear not, brother. I promised you an elegant outing, and I plan to deliver."
Kell hated the place the moment he saw it. It was called Rashanast, Splendor. Ruinously loud and riotously colorful, Splendor was a leisure palace where the city's ostra, their elite, could stave off the coldest months by simply denying their presence. Beyond the silver-plated doors, the winter night evaporated. Inside, it was a summer day, from the fire lanterns burning sun-bright overhead to the artificial arbor shading everyone beneath a dappled canopy of green. Stepping from the icy night with its curtain of darkened fog into the expansive, well-lit field, Kell felt suddenly, horribly exposed. He couldn't believe it, but he and Rye were actually underdressed. He wondered if Rye wanted to cause a scandal or a scene, to have his presence challenged. But the attendants at the doors either recognized the royal prince or Kell himself, and by extension Rye, since saints knew no one else could drag the Antare to such a fete, because the two were welcomed in. Kell squinted at the onslaught of activity. Banquet tables were piled with fruit and cheese and pitchers of chilled summer wine, and couples twirled across a blue stone platform made to resemble a pond, while others lounged on pillows beneath the enchanted trees. Wind chimes sang and people laughed, the high, bright laugh of aristocrats, and toasted their companions with crystal cups, their wealth like the landscape on display. Perhaps the whole charade would have been enchanting if it weren't so frivolous, so gaudy. Instead, Kel found it insufferable. Red London might have been the jewel of the Arnesian Empire, but it still had poor people and suffering, and yet here in the splendor, the Ustra could play pretend, craft utopias out of money and magic. On top of it all, Rye was right. No one else was wearing black, and Kel felt like a stain on a clean tablecloth. He thought of changing his coat, trading out the black for something brighter, but he couldn't bring himself to wear any of the peacock shades so in fashion this winter. As the prince put a hand on his shoulder and ushered him forward. They passed a banquet table, and Rye took up two flutes of summer wine. Kel kept his hat on, surveying the room from between the brim of the cap and the rim of the glass Rye pressed into his hands.
"Do you think they've seen through my disguise yet?" mused the prince, keeping his head bowed. "Or are they all too busy preening?"
Kel was surprised by the hint of judgment in his brother's tone.
"Give it time," he said. "We've only just arrived."
But he could feel the knowledge moving like a tremor through the room as Rye led them toward a sofa beneath a tree. The prince sank into the cushions and cast off his hat. His black curls shone, and even without the usual circlet of gold in his hair, everything about him, his posture, his perfect smile, his self-possession, registered as regal. Kel knew he couldn't mimic any of those things. He'd tried. Rye tossed his hat onto the table. Kel hesitated, fingering the brim of his own, but kept it on, his only armor against prying eyes. He sipped his drink and, having little interest in the rest of splendor, considered his brother. He still didn't understand Rye's half-hearted disguise. Splendor was a haunt for the elite, and the elite knew the prince's company better than anyone in the city. They spent months learning the royal tongue just so they could talk their way into his graces, even though Kel knew Rye found that habit uncomfortable and unnecessary. But the clothes weren't the only thing that bothered him. Everything about the prince was in its place, and yet...
"Am I really that good-looking?" asked Rye
without meeting his gaze, while glassy laughter chimed through the room.
"You know you are,"
answered Kel, dragging his attention to the carpet of grass beneath their feet. No one approached their couch save for an attendant, a young woman in a white dress who asked if there was anything she could do to make their evening more enjoyable. Rye flashed his smile and sent her in search of stronger drink and a flower. Kel watched as the prince stretched his arms along the back of the sofa, his pale gold eyes glittering as he surveyed the room. This was Rye at his most understated, and it was still dreadfully conspicuous. The attendant returned, holding a decanter of ruby liquor and a single dark blue blossom. Rye accepted the drink and tucked the flower behind her ear with a smile. Kel rolled his eyes. Some things didn't change. As Rye filled his glass, Kel caught a swell of whispers as more eyes wandered their way. He felt the inevitable weight as the collective gaze shifted from the prince to his companion. Kel's skin crawled under the attention, but instead of ducking his head, he forced himself to meet their eyes.
"This would be a good deal more fun," observed Rye, "if you'd stop scowling at everyone."
Kel gave him a withering look.
"They fear me. They worship you," said Rye with a wave of his hand. "The majority of the city thinks you're a god."
Kel cringed at the word. Antari magicians were rare, so rare that they were seen by some as divine, chosen.
"And the rest think I'm a devil?"
Rye sat forward.
"Did you know that in Vesk... they believe you turn the seasons and control the tide and bless the empire?"
"If you're appealing to my ego,
I'm simply reminding you that you will always be singular."
Kel stilled, thinking of Holland. He told himself that a new Antari would be born or found eventually, but he wasn't sure if he believed it. He and Holland had been two of a disappearing kind. They had always been rare, but they were rapidly approaching extinct. What if he really was the last one? Kel frowned.
I would rather be normal.
Now it was Rai's turn to wear the withering look.
Poor thing. I wonder what it feels like to be put on a pedestal.
The difference, said Kel, is that the people love you.
For every 10 who love me, said Rai, gesturing at the sprawling room, one would like to see me dead.
A memory surfaced of the Shadows, the men and women who had tried to take Rai's life 6 years before, simply to send a message to the Crown that they were wasting precious resources on frivolous affairs, ignoring the needs of their people. Thinking of Splendor, Kel could almost understand.
My point, continued Rai, is that for every 10 who worship you, one wants to see you burn. Those are simply the odds when it comes to people like us.
Kel poured himself a drink.
This place is horrible, he mused.
Well,
said Rai, emptying his own glass in one swallow and setting it down with a click on the table,
we could always leave.
And there it was, in Rai's eye, that glint, and Kel suddenly understood the prince's outfit. Rai wasn't dressed for splendor because it wasn't his true destination.
You chose this place on purpose.
A languorous smile.
I don't know what you're talking about. You chose it because you knew I would be miserable here and more likely to cave when you offered to take me someplace else. And?
And you greatly underestimate my capacity for suffering.
Suit yourself,
said the prince, rising to his feet with his usual lazy grace.
I'm going to take a turn around the room.
Kel glowered, but did not rise. He watched Rai go, trying to emulate the prince's practiced nonchalance as he sat back with his glass. He watched his brother maneuver through the field of people, smiling cheerfully, clasping hands and kissing cheeks, and occasionally gesturing to his outfit with a self-deprecating laugh. Despite his earlier remark, the fact was Rai fit in effortlessly.
As he should, Kel supposed.
And yet, Kel loathed the greedy way the Ostra eyed the prince. The women's batting lashes held too little warmth and too much cunning. The men's appraising looks now held too little kindness and too much hunger. One or two shot a glance toward Kel, a ghost of that same hunger, but none were brave enough to approach. Good. Let them whisper. Let them look. He felt the strange and sudden urge to make a scene, to watch their amusement harden into terror at the sight of his true power. Kel's grip tightened on his glass, and he was about to rise when he caught the edge of conversation from a nearby party. He didn't mean to eavesdrop. The practice just came naturally. Perhaps the magic in his veins gave him strong ears, or perhaps he'd simply learned to tune them over the years. It became a habit when you were so often the topic of whispered debate.
I could have entered, said a nobleman, reclining on a hill of cushions.
Come, chided a woman at his elbow. Even if you had the skills, which you do not, you're too late by measure. The roster has been set.
Has it now?
Like most of the city, they were talking of the Essentosh, the element games. And Kel paid them little mind at first, since the Ostra were usually more concerned with the balls and banquets than the competitors. And when they did speak of the magicians, it was in the way people talked of exotic beasts.
Well, of course, the list hasn't been posted, continued the woman in a conspiratorial tone, but my brother has his methods.
Anyone we know?
Asked another man in an airy, unconcerned way.
I've heard the victor Casimir is in again.
And what of Emre?
At that, Kel stiffened, his grip going knuckles white on his glass.
Surely it is a mistake, he thought, at the same time a woman said,
Alucard Emre? Yes, I've heard he's coming back to compete.
Kel's pulse thudded in his ears, and the wine in his cup began to swirl.
That's nonsense, insisted one of the men. You do have an ear for gossip. Emre hasn't set foot on London soil in 3 years.
"That may be," insisted the woman, "but his name is on the roster. My brother's friend has a sister who is messenger to the Arvin Essen, and she said..."
A sudden pain lanced through Kell's shoulder, and he nearly fumbled the glass. His head snapped up, searching for the source of the attack, as his hand went to his shoulder blade. It took him a moment to register that the pain wasn't actually his. It was an echo.
Rye. Where was Rye?
Kell surged to his feet, upsetting the things on the table as he scanned the room for the prince's onyx hair, his blue coat. He was nowhere to be seen. Kell's heart pounded in his chest, and he resisted the urge to shout Rye's name across the lawn. He could feel eyes shifting toward him, and he didn't care. He didn't give a damn about any of them. The only person in this place, in this city, he cared about, was somewhere nearby, and he was in pain. Kell squinted across the too bright field of splendor. The sun lanterns were glaring overhead, but in the distance, the afternoon light of the open chamber tapered off into hallways of darker forest. Kell swore and plunged across the field, ignoring the looks from the other patrons. The pain came again, this time in his lower back, and Kell's knife was out of its sheath as he stormed into the shadowed canopy, cursing the dense trees, the starlights in the branches the only source of light. The only other things in these woods were couples entwined.
"Damn it," he cursed,
his pulse raging as he doubled back. He'd learned to keep one of Rye's tokens on him just in case, and he was about to draw blood and summon a finding spell when his scar throbbed in a way that told him the prince was close. He twisted around and could hear a muffled voice through the nearest copse, one that might be Rye's. Kell shoved through, expecting a fight, and found something else entirely. There, on a mossy slope, a half-dressed Rye was hovering over the girl in white, the blue flowers still in her hair, his face buried in her shoulder. Across his bare back, Kell could see scratch marks deep enough to draw blood, and a fresh echo of pain blossomed near Kell's hips as her nails dug into Rye's flesh. Kell exhaled sharply, in discomfort and relief, and the girl saw him standing there and gasped. Rye dragged his head up, breathless, and had the audacity to smile.
"You bastard," hissed Kell.
"Lover?"
wondered the girl. Rye sank back onto his heels and then twisted with a languid grace, reclining on the moss.
"Brother,"
he explained.
"Go,"
Kell ordered the girl. She looked disconcerted, but she gathered her dress around her and left all the same, while Rye got unsteadily to his feet and cast about for his shirt.
"I thought you were being attacked."
"Well,"
Rye slipped the tunic gingerly over his head,
"in a way, I was."
Kell found Rye's coat slung over a low branch and thrust it at him, and then he led the prince back through the woods and across the field, past the silver doors and out into the night. It was a silent procession, but the moment they were free of splendor, Kell spun on his brother.
"What were you thinking?"
"Must you ask?"
Kell shook his head in disbelief.
"You are an incomparable ass."
Rye only chuckled.
"How was I to know she would be so rough on me? I'm going to kill you."
"You can't,"
said Rye simply, spreading his arms.
"You made sure of it."
And for an instant, as the words hung in the cloud of his winter breath, the prince seemed genuinely upset. But then the smile was back.
"Come on,"
he said, slinging an arm around Kell's shoulders.
"I've had enough of splendor anyway. Let's find somewhere more agreeable to drink."
A light snow began to fall around them, and Rye sighed.
"I don't suppose you thought to grab my hat?"